I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story.
Today, we stand here in a very different world. Australia and the world are now experiencing the most severe economic crisis since the Great Depression.
In June, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg confirmed Australia was in a recession.
Our economy has taken a big hit.
It's Australia's first recession in 30 years, and it's a recession like no other before it.
Between March and May, 870,000 jobs were lost, and more than 1 million Australians saw their working hours reduced, in many cases, to zero.
Caused by a global pandemic that has forced large sections of the economy to close.
These are mums and dads, sons and daughters, friends and colleagues.
Today, the reality of the pandemic recession. It's Thursday, the 30th of July. Groggs, do you want me to call you Greg or Groggs on this podcast?
Probably should call me Greg, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's be professionals.
Yes.
Greg Jericho is Guardian Australia's economics columnist. Greg, can you tell us a little bit about how the Australian economy is looking right now?
It's pretty much looking as bad as it's looked in just about anyone's lifetime who is listening to this.
Australia is tonight staring down the biggest economic disaster in almost a century. A COVID-19 spark catastrophe that will take at least 30 years to pay off.
We're in a recession, and it's going to be a deep recession.
The country is on the slow road to recovery, but the number of Australians out of work is predicted to remain high for some time. The Reserve Bank has predicted the economy.
There's been a massive increase in unemployment. We went from in March, 5.1% to now 7.4%.
The full extent of the misery this virus is inflicting on Australia is becoming clearer. Almost 1.5 million people expected to be thrown out of work within the next 2 months.
So these sound like they're pretty huge numbers. What do they actually mean?
What we're really talking about is job losses, and they're in June, there were 660,000 fewer people working than there was in March. I mean, that's just a massive amount of people who aren't working.
Wow. So we're really in uncharted waters here.
Yeah.
What has the government been doing to help these people?
Well, I mean, their two main ones have been the JobKeeper and the JobSeeker payments. The JobKeeper one is essentially one is to try and acknowledge the underemployment aspect, the fact that, okay, there are people who are not working hours, but the reason they're not working hours is because their business has been forced to shut. And so what the government has attempted to do with JobKeeper is, instead of in the past those people would be sacked or be retrenched and said, sorry, there's no job anymore because we can't open, what they've attempted to do is keep those people notionally employed. So say, okay, you don't sack them, but we'll essentially pay their wage for you. And that is also one of the reasons why the unemployment rate hasn't perhaps gone up as much, because people have been able to maintain notional employment even if they're not actually doing any work.
And what about for unemployed people? What do they do for unemployed people?
Australia is facing a war on two fronts. As the Prime Minister has said, we are facing a health crisis and an economic crisis at the same time.
For unemployed people, one of the things the government, I think, realised, both economically and politically, the old rate of job seeker was not fit for purpose. Politically, it was death for them, because suddenly they were getting nearly a million people accessing job seeker, and if they had been forced to survive on the old rate, they probably wouldn't have been all that inclined to reward the government for its economic management.
Mm.
And also, one of the things about an unemployment rate, and this is why we generally now don't go into things like the Great Depression, where back then, if you got unemployed, suddenly you had nothing and you had to go to a soup kitchen and there was no money at all for you. Now, with unemployment benefits, if you're unemployed, you still have some money, you can still spend. And so that way, in a recession where you get lots of people unemployed, there's still some money circulating through the economy. But what the government, I think, quickly realized was the old job seeker payment rate was far too low to do any of that. It was a pittance.
Hmm.
Where people have tragically lost their job, we've effectively doubled the safety net with the new job seeker coronavirus supplement.
And so what they decided was to offer a COVID-19 bonus payment of $550 extra a fortnight, which took it up to $1,115 a fortnight, which was at least above the poverty rate and meant that people who were unemployed would still have money to be able to buy essentials and keep that money flowing through the economy.
So you said it's a bonus. Does that mean they haven't raised the rate? They're just giving a bonus for a certain period of time?
Yeah, they're keeping the base rate as it is. They've extended out the job seeker bonus.
It's nice to have you here, and to everyone in particular in Melbourne and across Victoria. We continue to stand with you each and every day, and while today is about making announcements in relation to JobKeeper and JobSeeker, I can confirm that I've spoken with...
So, yeah, we heard last week that the government say they'd cut the COVID-19 bonus from $550 a fortnight to $250 a fortnight from the end of September. How long will that new bonus payment last?
Well, in the recent sort of budget update...
What we've also said is that we don't set and forget when it comes to these arrangements. We continue to look at them and we continue to calibrate them to ensure they're being effective. And where they need to change, we'll change them. Where they can work better, we will make those changes.
They announced it'll go to the end of the year. The Treasurer did actually say he was open to extending it. So there might be, in October when the budget is handed down, we might see an extension of it. I would like them to hopefully consider increasing the amount again, but that might be wishful thinking. But I just think, given the assumptions about what's going to happen in the economy that sort of underlined their extending it out.
What are those assumptions, Greg? Can you just...
Well, things like, that the Melbourne lockdown will only go for 6 weeks and then it'll be fine. And there doesn't seem to be a slackening of it. And I think everyone is kind of the view that 6 weeks seems now to be a bit wishful thinking, given, we're halfway through that. Other things involving, at the end of the year, international travel being eased and people being able to start travelling. There just seems to be, I don't want to suggest they're overly positive. They're not suggesting that, come the end of the year, suddenly we're going to have tourists and everything flocking in there. That there is still a sense that there'll be some restrictions in place. But I think even the assumptions that they've got are just a little bit too hopeful.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, David.
So let's start there. Why are you cutting the rate of these support payments in October, JobSeeker and JobKeeper, when our unemployment is still rising?
Well, David, we're actually extending the JobKeeper program beyond its legislated six-month life.
One of the problems with the government looking to end, for example, the JobSeeker bonus at the end of this year is even their own budget papers predict that by June next year, the unemployment rate will be 8.75%. I mean, we're talking 1.2 million people unemployed. The way recessions work is they take a long time to recover. And if the government is thinking that it's all going to be rosy by the end of this year, they're in a fantasy land.
That's what I'm asking about. Why now reduce these payments?
Well, these payments are going to continue and are going to be at a significant amount. So at $1,200...
Yeah, I'm asking why the reduction?
Ultimately, this is a program that at $11 billion cannot be continued, $11 billion a month.
So it costs too much. Is that the answer?
Well,
it costs too much.
At the end of the day, we have to make sure that our spending is sustainable. At $11 billion a month, that is an enormous...
Looking at past recessions, Greg, is there anyone in particular, any group of people who are most adversely affected by recessions?
Yeah, I mean, recessions, what we see, especially from if we look at the 1980s recession, the early 1990s recession, even the GFC to an extent, which some people don't call a recession, but I kind of think it is in terms of unemployment and labour force, is that we see massive changes in the labour force structure. We see a big rejigging of the workforce and generally away from full-time employment. What we see is men being affected, older men especially, and young people. With the older men, there's a danger, and we certainly saw this in the 1990s recession, where if you're in your late 40s, 50s, you lose a job. Getting a job back is very hard. Young people also massively affected. They're always the first people to be sacked because they haven't been working for very long. They don't have many skills. And it means that they can be in danger of losing a real sort of good sort of foundation those first 5 years or so in their 20s, where they would have normally been employed. If they have been employed, they haven't been getting many hours, haven't been able to build up their skills, work their way up to promotion. So it can sort of step them back.
I've seen some analysis that this recession was affecting more women than men. What are your thoughts on that?
It has. One of the reasons why this recession, certainly in terms of jobs, has most hit women and younger people is because of the type of industries that have been most hit are the ones that mostly employ women, and that's hospitality and retail. And so because they've been hit the most by the shutdowns, women have been the ones who have certainly lost more jobs than men, but it really is a case of what we'll see in a recession is everyone's losing jobs. You know, manufacturing and construction areas are losing their work. And the problem is when we're looking at coming out of a recession is the whole economy sort of slowed down.
Next, the government's plan for recovery. So you're painting a picture here of recessions that take years to recover from. It's not, you know, at the beginning, Scott Morrison was talking about snapback. That's just not what happens after a recession. But this pandemic may go on for years, right? We don't have a cure. We don't have a vaccine. What could that do to the economy?
Well, that's the real sort of fly in the ointment is that, you know, even in a quote unquote normal recession, you're talking, you know, almost double the length of time it took to fall as it does to recover. So if it takes, you know, if you takes 18 months to fall, you're talking 3 to 5 years to recover, and maybe even a decade if it's significantly bad. With this one, we've got that big fall, it's very fast, but it's a case of are we even able to recover if the things that have caused it are still around? So if there's no vaccine, how can we open up our economy to tourism and foreign students and the like, and it go back to the way it was? And one of the things with past recessions is it's mostly hit the manufacturing sector, but this recession could be different in that it might hit, because of the very nature of the pandemic, the accommodation and the food services sector, the hotels and the restaurants. If they don't come back, if the tourists don't come back, if the people going out to restaurants don't come back, if we sporting events, what's going to happen with sporting events? When are we going to see a full MCG again? If that doesn't quite come back to what it was, then we're going to have a very different type of economy to what we had 6 months ago, 7 months ago. That is a real worry.
Yeah, restaurants and things like that also depend on people's confidence, don't they? Because if the city's riven by a virus, you're not going to want to go out for dinner to a nice restaurant, are you?
No.
And we know that those businesses are often run like very close margins. Mm-hmm. So do you see some of the restaurants that have had to close now that some of them might never reopen?
Oh, that's a definite possibility, because what we've seen from previous recessions as well is that restaurant trade is a significant indicator of the health of the economy, because not only do you only go out and eat out at a restaurant if you feel safe that, you know, you're not going to catch a virus, you also only do it if you're feeling kind of flush with money. Otherwise, you're like, no, we'll just, you know, eat at home, you know, and even just generally, oh, let's go out and have drinks or things like that. It costs money to do that, and you're not going to do that if you're feeling worried about your employment situation. So there's two factors there. It's that factor one of the health issues, and also the economic health. How are people feeling in terms of their own income? And restaurants very much need both of those.
So in that sense, there's no way to separate the public health issue from the economic issue, is there?
No, I don't. And this is where I think the biggest error with those economists who have been suggesting, oh, you know, we've been too severe on the lockdowns and this has been the wrong way to go about it, is that to suggest that, oh, we'll just open everything up is to suggest that people are going to ignore their own concerns about health. I mean, you know, it's a case of, I know just in Canberra, we've had the cinemas have opened with restrictions, but, you know, I'm sort of thinking, do I really want to do that? and it's the same case with restaurants. So I'll be like, oh, no, let's just grab a takeaway maybe. I don't know if I want to sit in a restaurant with people.
Mm. So given all this, and given what we know about past recessions and what you've just told us about how long it takes to recover jobs, why has the government only committed to paying the JobSeeker supplement until December?
I think there's two things going on there. One, they wish to be hopeful and keep on a sort of a thing of a belief that, you know, we can get on top of this. The other aspect is the cost. It is a big cost. Extending it is costing an extra $3.8 billion. I think at this point, they've yet to fully divest themselves of concerns about budget deficits and debt. I think the announcement of, you know, that the deficit this current financial year is going to be $184 billion, I think that might be the point at which they realise no one's too concerned. It's not like the sky's fallen in because they've announced that. And I think they might be more willing in the October budget to face up to the fact that they can go a bit more long term. So I think also there's the other aspect of the longer they keep it in there, the more they have to admit that the previous rate was just pathetic. And perhaps politically they haven't quite reached that point yet.
Given from what you know from past receptions, what do you think they should be doing now?
One of the things that is different between this recession and previous recessions is the ability for governments to borrow money.
Mm.
It is incredibly cheap at the moment to borrow money. The government can borrow $2 billion for 10 years, and they're paying an interest rate of 0.8%, you know, nothing.
Practically nothing.
Mm. And that is a great opportunity for a government to look ahead and think, okay, we're not only in a terrible state of affairs where the government is actually going to have to play a bigger role in the economy than it was beforehand. What we've seen over the past 30 years is a shrinking of government, the sense that a small government is a good government, and that kind of works well when everything's working well. I mean, it doesn't work well for equality and provision of government services. But when you've got a case where we're in certainly in a recession, it looks like it's going to be ongoing. And depending on what happens with the virus and vaccines and so forth, it could be very much long going. It's just, you know, it's almost a fait accompli that government is going to have to take a bigger role. And so it's a case of, well, what does that mean? We could just keep providing money for job seeker, and certainly that should be increased. But it's a case of thinking, okay, what does our economy need in the future? And what economists always talk about is, well, we need things that are going to actually improve our productive capacity, because productivity is what generates living standards. It's us being able to produce more with the same number of hours, essentially.
Can you give us an example of what you need by that?
Well, I mean, even the Productivity Commission has done numerous reports. There was one of the more recent ones was 2017. And among the areas that it looked at was the health sector. There's always efficiencies to be improved in the health sector. Education is a key one. And education is a classic in terms of increasing productivity, because if you've got a smarter workforce, you're able to obviously work with technology and tools that enable you to produce things quicker and better. The other aspect that the Productivity Commission is very much focused on is energy, and being very mindful of the fact that we need to move towards a zero emissions economy. And what that needs is a real sort of move towards renewable energy. I think that that is a great opportunity for us. Because it just hits so many notes. It really is a chance for, one, us to do something about the environment, which is what we need to do, but also it does provide jobs. It also can be involved with investment in R&D for Australia to become sort of a renewable powerhouse.
And will they do any of that?
No. No, renewable energy is not really a big ticket item for this government. The Prime Minister no longer talks about snapback. That was the talk of March when we were trying to delude ourselves into that this would all pass quickly. So it's a case of realizing that this is going to be a long haul, and I don't think the government has got that sort of sense yet of, well, let's put in place things that are going to go beyond the short term.
Has the government given any hints about what's influencing their thinking or their ideology at the moment?
The phrase I've been using is a business-led recovery.
Go forward. So this is very much aligning the interests of employers and employees and giving business the best possible chance to get to the other side.
It remains very much stuck in the sense of, oh, the way to recover will be for government to shrink and to go back to being a small government, and governments can't employ people and don't create jobs. The old canards that they've been wheeling out for decades, even though as soon as we went into recession, suddenly they realised that actually governments do create jobs and you can actually produce things through government spending. And so,
or whether it's transparency and competition on the default market offer and price.
You did say when it comes to economic reform the other day that you'll be taking inspiration from Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan.
Really? Well, they dealt very successfully with the challenges that they faced, particularly stagflation, high unemployment, high...
What we've seen is rather horrifically, from my point of view, the Treasurer referring glowingly to Thatcher and Reagan and suggesting that they are a guide.
If you look at Margaret Thatcher, after Labor's winter of discontent, she came in, she reduced the number of days lost to industrial disputation from 30 million down to 2 million. She cut taxes and she talked about every earner being an owner.
Also went for some sweeping IR reform that might scare some workers.
Well, she had 11 and a half years, so she was doing something right by the people of Britain.
Which is bizarre, because what Thatcher and Reagan didn't really actually succeed. The main impact of their time in government was a massive increase in inequality and a reduction in the provision of government services such as health services, education. And it's kind of like, is that really what you're aiming for? Is that how you see the recovery? It just seems to be something very much out of step.
And when it comes to Ronald Reagan, he used to talk about two economists having three opinions, but what he did say is that, you know, cutting taxes, cutting red tape, so he was very successful.
Reaganomics
He boosted growth.
It's sometimes called trickle-down economics too.
Thatcher and Reagan are figures of hate for the left because they were so successful.
Thanks very much, Greg. That was fascinating.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Many thanks to Greg Jericho for his time and insight. If you liked today's episode, please leave a rating or review wherever you listen. It really does help other people find us. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater and Joe Koning. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. See you next time.